Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And the good news for conservatives, even before we get to the good martini, Jim, is that apparently conservative podcast hosts, conservative podcast listeners, and conservatives in general are just better looking than liberals. That's the official science research now. And even the Washington Post is reporting on this. This is just our little teaser ahead of the actual three martinis. A recently published study in the Journal of Public Economics concludes that the attractiveness of a candidate does correlate with their politics. They find that politics on the right are more good looking in Europe, the United States, and Australia. The study shows correlation, not causation, but the researchers float a simple economic explanation for why this might happen. Numerous studies have shown that good-looking people are likely to earn more, and that people who earn more are typically more opposed to redistributive politics, like progressive taxes and welfare programs favored by the left. So, Jim, we've always known this is true. I think it's just operating out of more of a pure heart and kind of the portrait of Dorian Gray that works against the left. But it's good to know that it's been confirmed by science.
It's science. And look, you know, why would you be a science denier, anybody out there? Now, I'm sure there's going to be a disputing about, do those rugged Australian guys and those dignified English guys, do they alter the average? I'm sure Charlie Cook's going to want to weigh in on this. I don't know the political perspective of Hugh Jackman. I'm sure if he is on our side, he definitely, you know, skews it a little bit. And obviously you and I do quite a bit to bring up the national average of U.S. conservatives.
Yes.
No, we're not surprised by this. And it's finally good to see we can do away with these superstitious beliefs on the left and use proven science in a serious journal to establish what everybody already knows through common sense.
Fantastic. All right. Stay humble, conservatives. Just because it's true doesn't mean we have to not be humble anymore. All right.
We're more humble than they are. They're profoundly humble, to quote the President of the United States. We are so humble, we need to tell you how much better our humility is than yours. So.
All right, let's get on to the actual official good martini now, Jim, and more spillover from yesterday's first martini, which was actually a crazy one, and that was the whole CNN report leading into BuzzFeed spilling the details of this intelligence dossier that has obviously turned out to be unverified. And it's been interesting to watch the food fight that's developed since then, because after Trump called out CNN and wouldn't let him ask a question at the press conference on Wednesday, CNN was quick to put out a statement explaining why what they did was way better than what BuzzFeed did, or at least what BuzzFeed did was way worse than what CNN did. That didn't seem to assuage the Trump fans too much. But now the mainstream media is kind of piling on BuzzFeed. You've got the New York Times and a lot of other publications saying, there's no way we were going to touch this. I can't believe you did. And even Chuck Todd over at MSNBC, talking with Ben Smith, the head of BuzzFeed, talking about how this is essentially fake news.
Don't you have a responsibility of not spreading false information? Are you knowingly spreading false information?
I mean, I think as with the Obama birth certificate thing during the Obama campaign, this is an incredibly difficult balance that everybody in our business navigates every day.
But you're not publishing a false. You're not publishing.
You are quoting people saying.
I understand, but did you publish a false birth certificate? I know this was not your intent. I've known you a long time. But you just published fake news.
And then Ben Smith goes on to say, no, we didn't publish fake news. It was a real dossier that they put around. It just turned out to be filled with stuff that wasn't true. So, Jim, it's fun to watch the food fight, not only as Trump spars with the press, but also as the left kind of eats their own, trying to save their own reputations here.
Yeah, look, I was kind of making this point yesterday, and I find it quite pleasing to see most of the world making this distinction. I mean, the CNN had reported on, here's the briefing. The briefing was on Russian elements of, you know, basically compromising information that Russia thought it had on Trump, but didn't go to detail, and certainly didn't go into the sordid details that were actually in the 35-page dossier. And then, of course, BuzzFeed said, oh, you mean this one? Here it is. Bloop. There, you know. I feel like there's a major qualitative difference there, and that there was some that CNN was kind of getting lumped in with them. And it's kind of good to see CNN standing up for itself. It's kind of good for everybody else making this distinction. And in today's Morning Jolt, I quoted Jack Schaefer of Politico. He says, look, because there are so many publications, you're never going to be able to keep information like this from getting out to the public, even if it is unverified, even if it is likely false. It's just the nature of the beast. And to me, it means something when Chuck Todd and all these other groups go out to Ben Smith and say, no, you shouldn't have done that, right? That's not journalism. That's not the job of a reporter. I mean, you know, you're supposed to be able to discern what is true and what is not true. Otherwise, you just become, you know, fill in the blank of which one unreliable source you prefer. Alex Jones, Debka File, Dan Rather. You know, you're basically saying here's something really exciting. It may or may not be true. And I, you know, whatever you want to call that, that's not journalism. That's not news reporting. And so I'm glad to see this. I don't know Ben Smith the way Chuck Todd does. And I think it was interesting that that right before he hit him with the, you know, you published fake news, he's like, look, I know you and I know you didn't mean to do this. Look, I'm old enough to remember, Greg, when Ben Smith reported that John Edwards was leaving the race because his wife had cancer. And of course, he ended up not doing that. I also remember him reporting that in, I believe, I would say March 2007, he reported Alberto Gonzalez was on his way out. And that the Bush administration was looking for a replacement of him as attorney general. That happened at the very end of the year, meaning that I don't think that was a particular, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, Greg, you and I can say Mattis is going to resign. And that will be true someday, right? Or God forbid he keels over. But, you know, everybody will leave office at some point. The more, you know, the question is when, right? At that point, you know, you don't really get a credit for reporting something will happen. And then it doesn't happen for, you know, close to a year. So my I'm glad to see Ben Smith getting whacked around like a pinata today. I think he and BuzzFeed had it coming. As I wrote in today's Jolt, there were pieces of this memo you could verify or dispel. We talked about Michael Cohen's trip to Prague yesterday. One section was about personnel moves at the Russian embassy. I just went online, was able to verify some of this stuff. That's what a reporter is supposed to do. And so good to see BuzzFeed getting whacked around. They have it coming. And hopefully, even though you're right, you know, because of the sheer proliferation of media organizations, you know, when there's a crazy rumor out there, somebody somewhere is going to report it. But, you know, those of us who want to be something better need to be reasonably unified in standing against this and saying, no, this is not how we do our business.
Let's move on to the bad martini now, Jim. And the way confirmation hearings go, it's usually one of two things. You've got the Mattis-style hearing where everyone is generally admiring of the candidate, or at least most people, even in the opposing party. Then you've got the Jeff Sessions style, where pretty much everyone on the nominating party loves the guy and everybody and the other party doesn't like him. And then you've got every once in a while a nominee where even some people in the nominating party don't particularly think too highly of the candidate. And that's the case with Rex Tillerson, the longtime Exxon executive who was Trump's choice to be Secretary of State. As a result of his relationship with the Russians, he's raising a skeptical eye from the likes of John McCain, Lindsey Graham, and Marco Rubio. Of those three, Rubio, I believe, is the only one who is on the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee. And he had some choice interactions with Tillerson on Thursday, this being one of them over Vladimir Putin and whether or not he's a war criminal.
Based on all this information and what's publicly in the record about what's happened in Aleppo and the Russian military, you are still not prepared to say that Vladimir Putin and his military have violated the rules of war and have conducted war crimes in Aleppo.
Now, those are very, very serious charges to make, and I would want to have much more information before reaching a conclusion. I understand there is a body of record in the public domain. I'm sure there's a body of record in the classified domain. And I think in order to deal with a serious question like this,
Mr. Tillerson, what's happening in Aleppo is in the public domain. The videos and the pictures are there.
Fully informed before advising the president.
And so he obviously didn't win over Marco Rubio. And unless he denounces Russia in a more substantial way, it looks like Lindsey Graham and John McCain won't be on board, although Cory Booker, who testified against Jeff Sessions, says he's perfectly fine with Rex Tillerson, so maybe he survives anyway. Jim, it's kind of a mixed bag with Tillerson. I think a lot of conservatives think Trump could have done better here. On the one hand, you've got folks like Graham and McCain who seem to want to warm up the missile launchers here when it comes to Russia, and so Tillerson's talking about a more pragmatic approach here. At the same time, though, like Trump, he doesn't seem all that worried about some of the things that a lot of us think he should be worried about when it comes to Putin.
Yeah, I was trying to keep an open mind with Tillerson. I want to say I think the initial media shorthand on him, oh, he got a medal from Putin, he's a Moscow stooge, you know, I don't think that's accurate. I think there was a decent explanation coming of what the Trump philosophy could be with Tillerson at the wheel, basically putting forth a policy of carrots and sticks. The administration wants to take a tough line when Russia operates against American interests. But they also, as Tillerson was kind of articulating this, Russia's primary goal is kind of a national pride. They want to be taken seriously. They want to be treated as a big deal, perhaps a sentiment that the president-elect understands as well. And if you know the attitude of the Obama administration has been to refuse them this, to emphasize that they are not a rising power, that they are not somebody who exports something the world needs other than oil, gas, and weapons, which are three things the world really does need. And kind of this belittlement of Putin, which is, you know, in a way, some ways, look, maybe Putin has that coming. But on the other hand, it certainly raises the stakes and makes them more antagonistic. If we can flatter Putin's ego and that gets him to do things that are not against our interests, then maybe this will pay off. If they don't, and we do find ourselves finding our allies threatened and serious destabilization in the Middle East, then we take a harder line on them. I'm still kind of thinking through this approach, but this doesn't strike me as a wildly unreasonable approach to dealing with Russia from a neither excessively hawkish nor excessively conciliatory approach to Moscow. All that having been said, Greg, I was underwhelmed when he said that, oh, at Exxon, we never lobbied against sanctions. We just told lawmakers what the consequences would be. Okay, Greg, you think they said, yeah, the consequences won't be so bad. Go right ahead. You know, when you tell lawmakers, ah, this is going to cause giant problems to GDP. It's going to really hurt our expansion plans and exports. And ah, this is going to, you know, giant, you know, economic consequence. Well, then, you know, what do you think the lawmakers are going to do? So he got a little too cute there. And my suspicion is he came in with enough wariness that answers like that could end up costing him a bit when the final vote comes.
It could. The thing that's best in Tillerson's favor, and I'm not a huge Tillerson fan. He's a squish on climate change and a number of issues that I think are important for that position. Look who he'd be replacing. I'm pretty sure Rex Tillerson wouldn't bring James Taylor to a country that just got hit by a terrorist attack. I'm pretty sure.
True enough. True enough. By the way, you mentioned his past statement saying he believes in climate change and he believes in Exxon has made various steps trying to look at limiting carbon emissions. I mentioned that when Tillerson was first named and how this was a staple of just about every major Tillerson speech. And you'd be amazed, Greg, how many Trump people said, oh, he doesn't really believe that. Well, how do you know? I just know. But, you know, he's just saying that for PR purposes. It's entirely possible. If you think global warming and climate change is cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, then I don't know how much you help the effort to dispel it as truth by running around saying, I totally believe in this. Right? I mean, at some point you have to stand up for what you believe in. I just don't know if you can say, oh, deep down, I know he believes the same thing I believe. But then I guess I suppose you could say we saw a lot of that during the Republican presidential primary, didn't we, Greg?
Just a little. Yeah, absolutely. So as we head to our crazy martini now here, Jim, I mean, what topic would possibly flow more naturally out of our geopolitical relationship with Russia than this? The San Diego Chargers, my first favorite NFL football team. Back in the 1980s, I grew up in the Midwest. All the teams were terrible. And then the late game would come on and Dan Fouts would sling it all over the field to Charlie Joyner and John Jefferson and Kellen Winslow. And no matter who won, the final score was 45-41 because the Chargers couldn't play defense. And that's why they never actually went to or won a Super Bowl during that time. But man, were they fun. I had the Chargers pajamas. I had the Chargers bathrobe. I had the Chargers letter jacket. Winter hat, the whole kit and caboodle. That's going to be worth some stuff now if I actually still have it back in my parents' house. The Chargers plan to announce as early as Thursday that they are moving to Los Angeles for the 2017 season. League sources said, this is from ESPN, ending a 55-year stint in San Diego and returning to their birthplace. The franchise played its inaugural season in Los Angeles in 1960 before moving to San Diego in 1961. Basically at issue, the Spanos family, which owns the Chargers, they've been looking for a new stadium for 16 years. I have been to the current stadium. It was there in about 2003. It is a hole. I can understand why they want a new one. I can also understand, based on precedent in other cities, why the city doesn't want to just roll out that many millions and billions of dollars for it or raise taxes on people. The people of San Diego had a chance to vote on this in November. They shot it down. I don't blame them either. So the Chargers are going to be in the brand new fancy football stadium once it's built in L.A. in a couple of years. In the meantime, they're looking for a home, and it looks like they'll be in L.A. next season in some form or function. So, Jim, on the one hand, kudos to the taxpayers for actually realizing that that's a terrible deal for them. I understand what Spanos is doing. I wish he would stay, but it sucks to watch him move.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. Look, I'm somebody like you who hates seeing taxpayer dollars used to build sports arenas and sports stadiums. They never pay off in the end. They always end up as becoming giant subsidies to millionaires and billionaires. This is not what the purpose of local government is supposed to do. You need a little help with, say, the traffic areas, the highway interchanges, or some sort of way to get, okay, fine, you know, building a new rail line to get to it. That's a slightly different story. But if, you know, the stadium, particularly if you're going to own the stadium, then by golly, you know, you're the person who builds it should own it. You should not have the taxpayers writing off for the construction costs and then allowing the owner itself to not only own it, but sometimes even give the sell off the naming rights. So all of a sudden you get extra money for naming something that you yourself didn't build. By the way, Spanos and the Spanos family is worth about $2.1 billion. You have the suspicion that if he deep down in his bones refused to move the team from that particular city, he could find a solution. There are various ways to do this. You don't need to make the city pay for the stadium. But he's decided, by golly, I don't want to pay for this. And he thinks L.A. will take care of him. Now, they don't have, you know, the Rams moved. They're playing in the Coliseum. Apparently, the Chargers are going to go to the smallest facility in the entire NFL. And of course, this is a city where they already have one team. The Rams weren't really good this year, but LA at least used to play back in LA back in the 80s. So there was a fan base that was kind of excited to see them come back. There was some talk that the Raiders might return to LA. They had spent a good portion of the 1980s in Los Angeles. So now the Chargers are abandoning a city that was their home for 50-some years to go to a city that isn't their team, where they're going to be the second team. And they you know, neither team has been particularly good this time. And as you know, one local columnist predicts, the biggest game of the year is going to be when the Raiders play.
That's right.
You know, it just is, you know, exactly the sort of scenario you hate to see in sports, because I think San Diego voters did the right thing. You're not supposed to use PAC's dollars on a sports stadium. It is not the public interest. That is a private interest. But now the sports fans are suffering for that. And I'm sure their fans in Cleveland know what they're talking about. Fans in Baltimore, fans in St. Louis. Sports fans deserve better. And this is going to light up the lines on sports radio for probably the next couple of months. My heart is broken for you, San Diego Chargers fans. You deserve better. Not just from a lousy team, but then have your team abandon you in the offseason like that. If I'm Commissioner Goodell, I want to minimize moves like this, because this is the sort of thing that makes people just turn away from sports, thinking it's like a bunch of millionaire and billionaire mercenaries who forget what the whole thing is about. So
millionaires and billionaires.
You'll rant right here.
Millionaires and billionaires, as Bernie Sanders.
This is going to turn us into Bernie Sanders.
Couple tips here. First of all, I'm pretty sure there's no pro team that plays in the Rose Bowl, so I'm not really sure why you can't play there. Also, for the Spanos family, who's been trying to fleece the city for the last 16 years, you know, there's a guy who led a pretty good effort about 20-some years ago to build a new stadium by raising a lot of different support, although I do think there was some public money involved there. It was for the Texas Rangers' new stadium. He ended up becoming governor of Texas, and I'm not really sure what happened to him after that. But George W. Bush, I think, was his name.
You know, the best example I can find locally, Greg, back when they had to build, okay, I think it's called the Verizon Center. It used to be the MCI Center.
Yes.
Where the Capitals and what I'm old enough to think of them as the Bullets, the Washington Wizards play,
right,
as well as the Georgetown Hoyas and things like that. One of my senior projects in journalism was to look at that, the proposals for that. And the short answer is the only thing the Washington, D.C. had to donate was the land. They had a spot of land in Chinatown. And let me tell you, in the early to mid 90s, you did not go to Chinatown alone at night. Right? This was a rough, bad neighborhood. The city donated the land, but the owner paid for the construction of the arena. And it actually turned out pretty good. You know, if all things considered, it definitely revitalized the neighborhood. It definitely did build a lot. But also, it's an urban area. It's not like one of these stadiums where it's out in the suburbs. You got to drive out to the middle of nowhere to it. Secondly, but arena, you can use that for concerts. You can use that for all kinds of different events year-round, more than a football stadium. Football stadiums and baseball stadiums are built for particular shapes and configurations and aren't easy to use. Basically, they sit unused for long stretches of the year. So if you got to do it, I can live with circumstances in which the city seems to get a good deal, all things considered. This does not look like a good deal, and this looks like a grotesque parody of greedy NFL owners that that I think really endangers the future popularity of the sport.
Sad day. Jim, on that note, we'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.